This is Alonzo Bowden. I want to welcome you to episode 362 of my podcast, Who's Paying Attention? I have talked about this next guest. This is honestly one of my favorite people on earth. I always say this, that when he is promoted as the smartest man on earth, it is arguably true. And I will argue with you that it is true. That is the name of his podcast, The Smartest Man on Earth. He recorded a live show on New Year's Eve in San Francisco. And you probably know him from Whose Line Is It Anyway, which is not only touring live, but also coming back to TV. Ladies and gentlemen, my old friend Greg Proops.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Alonzo. How are you, buddy?
I'm great, man. It is so good to see you. Now, reasons that we haven't had you here, we were talking about a little off air, is you are back in business big time.
Yeah, we didn't work for a year and a half, and I got depressed and drove my wife crazy, as you do, because, you know, that gaping hole where your soul should be that requires the approbation of strangers every 15 to 30 seconds as they validate you and your life. And that, and then you go through the, am I funny still? Because I'm just depressed. Yeah, now we're back and we're doing like 100 dates this year with Who's Live. And it's me and Ryan Stiles and Jeff Davis and Joel Murray. And we've had Gary Anthony Williams sitting in with us lately.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I love Gary.
Because Joel got a TV show, so blah, blah, blah. Yeah, Gary's awesome. So
yeah, Gary's
we've really
character.
Blown
He's
it out.
Great.
It's been nice.
So let me ask you this about the show, because and to my audience, to my listeners, most of you remember this show. These were the four of the most brilliant improv guys you can imagine. And Hollywood said, oh, they're doing improv. We'll hire four comics and make a copy of the show, which Hollywood found out. It's really not that easy because you guys were the best at it, are the best at it. But is there a situation you've not been ready for in doing all these improv shows with everything that comes up in the moment and the fact that you each come up with these crazy characters in situations? Has there ever been a moment where you're like, uh-oh?
Well, there's been a few hoedowns and a few songs where I haven't thought of anything. And so you do it again, and then you do it again. And then usually if I swear – if I use some profanity, they'll stop tape, and that gives you a chance to kind of settle your hash and then get going again. And live, only once in a while when there's someone super drunk or something like that. We did a show that was wildly unsuccessful years ago called Improvaganza for the Game Show Network, I think it was. And we did it in Vegas. And like, so you're doing an improv show in Vegas. I think it was at Caesars, right? So everyone's got those gigantic booze glasses with the
my favorite thing in Vegas is it's the only place you could be drinking a 4-foot-tall margarita at 9 a.m. And yeah, people are like, where'd you get that?
Yeah, right. That looks good. And we're doing some game sound effects or something. And they brought up some frat dude. And like, I don't bring up men on stage. I mean, there's a lot of men on stage to begin with, so I like a little female energy. And they brought up a dude with a baseball hat. And he went like this for 5 minutes on camera. Woo! Woo! And I was like, I thought to my – and then I went backstage and said to everybody, if anyone brings up another frat dude, it's over. Like, just – so once in a while. But as far as, like, being stumped, not really. But mind you, like, when we're doing the TV show, I got Wayne Brady, Colin Mockery, and Ryan Stiles. So right. It's like playing with Gretzky and Messier and, you know – I mean, they just hit the biscuit in the basket.
Well, I wanted to ask about this. How do you learn to do this? It's obviously a talent and a skill, but by definition, it's improv. So it's not like, oh, let me go home and rehearse improv. Rehearse improvisation for an hour. Like, how do you learn it?
The best part of it is we don't have to rehearse. I was in college, and I'd been doing stand-up. This is the late 70s, early 80s. And so I knew about stand-up. And I'd heard – I didn't really know about improv. Like, I'd heard of Second City, and I knew the committee, and they're a San Francisco group. And, you know, on TV was whatchamacallit, Michael McKean's group, Ace Trucking Company, mm-hmm. Credibility Gap. There was all those – they kind of did, you know, the variety shows.
Right.
And I think they did a lot of improv that they based their. So I went anyway. Long story. There was a there was a cantina at San Francisco State, and they put on an improv show, and I'd never seen one, so I went and watched. And the artist Keenholz said, the California school artist Keenholz said, when he was little, his parents took him to see a Rembrandt show, and he looked at it and went, "I can do that." Which I always thought was hilarious. So I was maybe 19, and I watched this improv show, and I thought, I can do that. And they did an audience thing. Can we have a volunteer? And we'll do this improv with you. So the next week I went, and I sat in the front on the floor, and they said, can we have a – and I got up before anybody could get up. And I did an improv with a guy, Reed Rallman, who I'm still friends with. And the next day he said, do you want to be in the group? And so wow. I joined the group and I learned all the games from them. I learned how to play all that stuff and sing and everything. I didn't go to Second City. I didn't go to the Groundlings or any of that jazz. I'm not knocking it. People do it. But it does cost a lot of money and there's a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And as we found over the years, they're not, how do I put this gently, as egalitarian as they might be. So I learned from the other kids, and that was – and then Whose Line came along about 10 years later. And by that point, I was firmly a stand-up. Yeah. I mean, I'd been in an improv group, but I was really a stand-up, and I went back and improvised. And part of Whose Line is it's jokey. Like, I don't know how many of your listeners are improv purists, but as you know, comics generally hate improvisers, and improvisers hate comedians.
Right.
Because comics think improvisers aren't funny. Why not – prepare something funny, and improvisers think comics are self-interested assholes, which is generally
we have a bit of that.
Yeah,
yeah,
and so you know, Whose Line isn't long form, like, you know, when you go to see these groups that are doing like a whole Shakespeare,
right,
or a whole Star Trek, or a whole Jane Austen, or a whole musical, which groups do all over the country, and by the way. Our show made it more popular because everybody subscribed.
Oh, absolutely.
To us.
Absolutely.
Took it in high school, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Because your show brought it to an audience that hadn't seen it.
Yep.
And so, yeah, you definitely made it popular. And like I said, I remember in the late 90s, networks trying to imitate. And what they were doing was they'd get four and three or four, yeah, and they could be great comics. Yeah. But being a great comic doesn't make you a great improv artist. Because when people talk to me about improv, I tell them, I'm good at verbal improv. Like, I can do crowd work all day.
Yeah.
You can give me just something, you know, give me a newspaper and I'll read it and make it funny. But that's not improv like you guys do, which I think the network quickly found out, like, oh, wait, there's something more to this.
The first year we did it, and I won't name any of the executives, I used to sit in the green room and we'd do two shows, and I'd watch the first one and be in the second one. And they'd go, you know who we should get to do this? Tom Cruise. You know who we should get to do this? Dustin Hoffman. And it was like, I would think, well, they might be okay, but you have to understand you're throwing them into literally a shark tank.
Yeah.
Like, we throw the ball backwards to each other without looking, and we joke. There's no dead air on our show. And so the idea that you're going to bring a wonderful actor who, if you give them time to rehearse and learn their character, and they'll do something marvelous with it, and instead of that, take that all away from them and put you out there with Wayne Brady and go, sing. Sing about a dog and make it really funny.
Right.
And do it in reggae. Is that okay too? Then they're not going to be able to do it. Like,
well, you know.
Bryan Cranston, I remember seeing on an improv show, he did really well because he committed immediately. Well, it was some MB, or it was like an Australian one, and they brought it to the network. And of course, they didn't have any of us on it. But,
right.
It was an Australian format, and they had all these different stars on it, Jennifer Coolidge, da-da-da-da. And Cranston was the only one I saw. Like, they threw the improv at him, and he just locked in and came in big. And, like, that's the whole show, is to come in big and don't faint. You know, brass it out no matter what happens.
No matter which way it goes, you're in.
Well, because they said, do you guys fail and stuff? And it's like, yeah, it's called television, so – like, if it's something terrible, you're not going to see it.
Right.
It'll be on the blooper reel later.
So now I want to shift over to stand-up. because and I can't speak to your early stand-up because I started in 93.
Oh, my.
But I will say that I've known you since the 90s. Yeah. I met you early on in my career. And I will say this about your comedy. You have been unapologetic from way before it was a thing. And now with, you know, let's just say in the past 10 years where it has been a thing where, oh, comics have to apologize for saying this or you said that years ago. And the other thing is you do not dumb down either your comedy nor your vocabulary. Now, I'm talking to my audience. We used to do a show here on NPR called Comedy Congress.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to tell the audience, I'm only here to translate to you what Greg Proops just said. I'm going to tell you what he said. But you have never, again, I've never known you to be either apologetic or to pander to an audience. And also, I will say that the fact that you do have an extensive vocabulary, an extensive knowledge, you don't lord that over people. You don't, in other words, you don't use it for like I'm intentionally going to say something that I know you don't understand. Like I've never got that from you. How did you find that? I mean, obviously it's your personality, but as an early comic, was there ever a time when you were like, this isn't working or they're not keeping up or time to throw in a dick joke?
Oh, so much. I mean, you know, I started as a teenager and then started doing like, I was in a comedy team in San Francisco in the early 80s, like 82, 83, and we were so not funny. Like, no such thing as dead air. No such thing as letting a punchline land, you know, because you're rushing to the next one because you're so bloody afraid that they're going to find you out. So we did song parodies and commercial, you know, all the shit that people hate comedy teams for. Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously, I'd known him since we were kids, and I'm still friends with him, Forrest Brakeman. He lives over here. But I mean, so then it was rush, 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 you know. And then by the end of working with him for a couple of years, I started to feel a little more confident on stage. Like I could, I didn't have to hide behind the material and the dick jokes. I could come out and, you know, or what we were doing, like pot jokes, which are always so hilarious, and which of course I still do. And then I wasn't in a team. I was in an improv group. And then when I came back to stand up when I was like 25 or 26, I started as an opener, and when you're the opener, you have to do all the business. You know, put your business card in the fishbowl.
Right, drink specials.
Or... Yep, Tuesday night is, as we used to say, big dick T-shirt night, and then the feature for a couple years, which is the sweetest slot in all of comedy. If you're a shit hot feature, you can do 25 minutes and scorch the headliner to the point where they have to be really funny. And like, and mind you, this was the '80s when I was doing this. So headliners weren't that great. There were some weak ass fucking headliners.
Yeah. Man. And again, to the audience, the '80s was the boom of comedy. Yeah. And the downside of the boom was everybody called himself a comic.
Uh-huh.
So there were people out there. Cause I came up right after the '80s. And as George Wallace always reminds me, I got in after the money.
But, right,
but they were like, yeah, they were used car salesmen and whatever. My buddy,
Doctors, he
used
lawyers.
To call, he said, you know, the guys selling mattresses at 1 a.m. Yeah, they were headlining.
Yep.
So to the audience, that's what he's talking about when he says the headliners weren't necessarily that strong. There were some great comics.
I was going to say there were some brilliant, brilliant comics who I learned everything from. And then when I'd go on the road in middle, I worked with guys who were sometimes TV writers, or basically they were destined to do a one-man show. I'm putting it gently. And so their material wasn't as inspired as it might have been. I remember one gentleman I worked with said to me, you're a pedant because of my vocabulary. And I said, I'm also a pedagogue and an autodidact, and what are you going to do about it? And
Let's take a break for the audience to Google those words.
Right? Because he was doing very silly stuff as the headliner, and I was doing a little more cerebral stuff. Not that I'm so genius, but just there was a little more.
Again, it's your personality, though. It's not an act you put on.
No. And also, the vocabulary, I always figured if you put enough context around it, they're going to understand. Joe Klosik, who I don't know if you know from San Francisco, once said to me, it's like you're dictating a novel. You're not writing a comedy act. And I always thought that's very flattering. And the truth is, I'm a lot more influenced by books and journalism as much as stand-up. You know, like, I love Carlin and Pryor and all the geniuses. Yeah. The things I steal to make my own, because as you know, geniuses steal and hacks do homage. You know, you steal the idea outright, and then no one knows that you stole it because you've made it your own. Yeah. You've done it. You're not copying it. You're making it an original based on something that you loved, which is different than listening to someone's act and taking the fucking jokes and doing them, which is horrible. I'll steal from authors the whole idea, the whole concept, the whole way to structure a sentence, or steal a line like what was it? I used to do a Jessica Simpson routine, which I'm not that proud of, but it was really funny at the time. She starts to think and the world shifts slightly on its axis, and you could fairly hear the steam singing out of her nose. Now, I stole that line, but it fit so perfect that I thought – so it took me a long time to get the confidence. And then I went to England in 1989, and I was 29. And then I started to go back to England a bunch, and I toured. And after I started to play Scotland, Ireland, England, Wales, for crowds that knew me from telly but didn't know what I was going to do, I got my confidence together like I never did on the road here. Like, you know, you do the road and it makes you better.
Right.
Because every time, as Doug Stanhope once said to me, I don't fix anything till it don't work.
Yeah.
Like, this routine ain't working, now I'll fix it. And that's because the road teaches you – you know, every night you've got to make them laugh
right.
at the same joke, and you've got to sell it. And when you stop selling it is when it starts to be stale. Once I went to England and did it for foreigners and then Australia, and, you know, then I was like, you can't touch me anymore. I can sell this idea to anybody. People who don't quite know what I'm talking about, people whose cultural references are over here, and I'm minor over here.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know? I loved doing overseas comedy because you like you said, you have to get better, and you have to figure it out for them. Like and you have to make it make sense for them. You know, the biggest export we have as Americans is our culture. They know all about our culture,
yeah, they do.
But we have to. Feed it to them in their language, or in their language is not the right word. Obviously, they're speaking English, but from their perspective.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
And that brings up something I want to talk to you in the podcast about, but I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
I'm not there yet because I'm still enjoying you as a stand up. So now, again, in the past 10 years, the apology started, the finger pointing started, the how dare you say that. I cannot hear Greg Proops apologizing for any joke he has said.
Well, I've tried to remain on the side of the angels. And by that I mean, like, I'd never make fun of homeless people or the poor.
Right. Well, you know, you never – I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the people, the people you have gone after. I'm not talking about – no, you're not going to be aiming at any low-hanging fruit or any of that. But you know, people have talked about people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I've said horrible things about people. I've called people Nazis. I've said I wish they'd die. I've called them racist pigs to their, you know, which people get upset about. As you know, the racist one is really touchy for white people. They can handle almost anything except being called what they are.
Yeah.
And then they get freaked out. And then they'll go, well, you can't. And I love that. You can't say that. You can't say that it's racist. And I'm like, I can and I am because you are and you is. And like, so, you know, the only thing I regret in my comedy career is that I've hammered on a lot of women who were high on drugs. And I might have gone a little gentler on them. I might have taken into account that maybe their life wasn't a golden fucking moment. That there's a reason why they slept with people and did drugs, because their life was a mess. And that I regret slightly. Although Craig Ferguson, as you recall, said at one point, I'm not doing it anymore. I'm not going to make fun of these women. And I thought at the time, oh, you big sissy. And then, of course, a couple years later, I'm like, yeah, you're right. That wasn't as funny.
Well, you know something? I don't agree. And Craig, And he talks about it publicly, so I'm not speaking out of turn. Right. But part of that came from the fact that he's in recovery.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm in recovery, and I've been in recovery
for
a long time.
Yeah.
And you know what? I always said, that doesn't give me a pass. Yeah. Like, when I was, you know, cracked out and I did something stupid, yeah. I don't get a pass because, well, you know, I was on drugs. Well, you still did it. Yeah. So
you have to take personal responsibility.
If you're a public figure and you do something crazy, dumb, ridiculous in public, then I'm allowed to make fun of it.
Yep.
You know, I mean, listen, Daryl Strawberry was good for the 90s. You know, I always said the thing I loved about Daryl was I just wrote one bit and he kept bringing it back.
Yeah. Every time you thought the bit went away, he would do something else. Isn't that hilarious? There are certain people that you think I'm letting that go. And then they keep coming back with it. It's just crazy. No, I think you're right. I've always felt that way. If they're above you and they're a public figure, they're absolutely fair game. I quit drinking like a year ago. It'll be a year in like a week. And you know me, I'm pretty high all the time. For a variety of reasons that no one needs to know about. And I'm not going to be boring about it because I think that's the boringest thing is to talk about it. And I don't care if you get high. Hooray. Mm-hmm. But like I agree with you in that regard. I take responsibility for everything all the horrible shit I said on stage that I was high and drunk and like letting it go because, you know, you can really lose your inhibitions up there and all of a sudden you're drunk with the microphone, drunk with power. But yeah, you know, apologizing to the crowds, I'm more like I want them to apologize to me for not getting enough or not reading enough or not being hip enough to go with the concept. Although I've learned, and it's taken so long. You know, Alonzo, like I always say, people go, how long have you done it? I'm like, so long that I should really be funnier. I mean, like, my wife will say to me, why do you keep doing this bit that doesn't work? Because it's so caustic, and you haven't couched it in any clever way. You're simply, like, you know, Carlin got away with that. Because mm-hmm. Carlin was such a great performer and such an economical writer. He was, like, listening to... I don't know if you're familiar with like Samuel Beckett, the playwright. He does these existential dilemmas and hangs everything on like a sentence. And it's not necessarily entertaining or funny, but it's the essence of the idea. And I feel like when Carlin gets on, boy, these conservatives are really something. No prenatal?
Yeah.
No. And he lists 15 things
right.
because that's how he did things.
Yeah, and there was a rhythm to it that he could have said anything in that rhythm, and it worked.
And sometimes there's no jokes.
Right.
I mean, there's literally no jokes. He's literally absolutely saying how he feels mm-hmm. and what he thinks. And he's distilled it because he didn't improvise. I remember going to see him at the Comedy Store, and he hadn't memorized a bit. And he goes, do you mind if I read this? I don't. Improvise and memorize. And he took a piece of paper out of his pocket and he read it. And because you know how we are, you're always trying to get your voice.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that people misunderstand about comedy is like they go, oh, well, I'm helping you because I yelled at you and shit. It's like, I'm trying to word this in a specific way, unless I'm riffing. And even when you're riffing, I'm still trying to word it.
Yeah, because like, you're going to say it different ways and then one of them's going to work.
Right. So, like when you listen to Carlin, his voice was so focused. That when he read it off the paper, it was just as funny. And I turned to my wife and I'm like, oh my God. Because he read a bit. And then later, of course, I saw him do it on HBO, the same bit.
Yeah.
But now he'd memorize it. And I think his point of view and Bill Hicks used to say, less jokes and more me. Right. And I kind of was acquainted with Bill. We weren't buddies, but I mm-hmm. knew him pretty well before he died and everything. And he was a straight up guy. And the more I heard about him from other people that knew him better or were even children around – I swear to you, I met a kid. This is on this. As Kamala Harris would say, to your point. I met a kid. It was like an agent type at a party. And when he was 14 or 15, he used to hang out in Texas and Bill Hicks was the king of the mm-hmm. room. And he said he was trying to do open mics. And Bill Hicks goes, you ever read Catcher in the Rye? And the kid goes, no. He says, the next week, he goes, Bill brought me the book and goes, go home and read it. And when you come back, we'll talk about it. This is stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
So the kid goes home and reads Catcher in the Rye and comes back the next week. And Bill goes, well, what do you think it's about? And he goes, I had to give him a book report.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he said, so understand that that was Bill Hicks too. Yeah, he did cocaine and he was crazy with all the guys and Kinison and all that. But like, I think he had a deep devotion to instruction. You know Ornette Coleman, right?
Yeah.
The free jazz artist. Right. I don't want to lose your audience here, but Ornette Coleman was a genius, and Ornette Coleman never apologized or ever spoke down to the audience. He did what he did. If he didn't dig it, you're free to fucking.
Right.
So melody, harmony, syncopation, all those things were upturned. And I really feel like there was an interview with him before he passed, and someone said, what are you doing on stage? Because if I saw him, and of course it was exultant.
Mm-hmm.
It was confusing and weird and amazing, and then eventually the sound took over, and he got to everybody. There was a sharp exhalation of breath when he finished the number. Not cheering, but
yeah,
which was a whole different...
Which happens in the presence of genius when you get it.
Yeah. And they said, what are you doing on stage? And he said, teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's how you look at your art. Like, you know, Ornette Coleman thought, you need to learn from me what sound is, what jazz is. Jazz is one thing, but it's also another thing. It's not always melody.
Well, what you said about Bill Hicks and the open micer, I think that speaks to the love of the art of comedy. It speaks to Bill Hicks saying, okay, learn something and then get up here and say something.
Yeah.
And respect comedy enough to put that part of the work in, which, you know, some do, some don't, right? And yeah. we live in a short attention span era. So a lot of times you don't have to do that. You just bang, 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 and it works. And then there are people like when you look at Carlin, when you look at Pryor, you know, people, they don't even realize what they were doing. I mean, I'll admit that was me with Miles Davis. I listened to Miles Davis for years before it clicked. And then I was like, oh, that's what everyone was talking. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Now I have to listen to all of this again.
Right.
Because now, and what I realized was, no, I'm not going to understand it all, but he's doing something that is different than what anyone else was doing. And then they were all playing catch up. And when they did, he said, okay, now I'm going to do something else because all of you caught up to that. You know,
and he did it time after time.
Time after time, yeah. And right up to the very end when he was doing hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know.
And people, Michael Jackson covers.
Right, right.
Which and, people were like, what are you doing? That's horrible. And he was like, fuck you, man.
Yeah.
You don't even understand
what this
I'm
is
doing.
Great. Yeah. This is great.
I'm doing Human Nature.
So I have to jump to this past week. Okay, but I'm not even going to look at this.
Okay.
I'm going to give you my view. I want yes, to know what you think.
I've been waiting to hear your view on this.
Well, people have been, I don't believe it, oh my God. And I'm like, the Republicans have been saying they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade since Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans have said, we don't like women, we don't like minorities, we don't like black people from the beginning. There's nothing they're doing, we love guns, we want the right for everyone to carry a gun everywhere. We think it's a good idea for teachers to carry guns.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that they're doing is exactly what they said. You know, it's just like Maya Angelou said, when someone tells you who they are, listen.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these people who say, I don't believe it, I'm like, no, I'm not mad at the Republicans for doing what they said they were going to do. I am mad at the Democrats for... The Republicans told you what they were going to do, and you sat back and you did absolutely nothing. And the other thing I said, if it were reversed, if the Republicans, if there was a liberal supermajority in the Supreme Court, the Republicans would have expanded the court before the court made one decision.
Oh, yeah. If there'd be 21 justices.
Exactly. Exactly. So I am not... I am, and I did read something that you said about this, and I think we're on the same page with this. Remember when you couldn't vote for Hillary?
Mm-hmm.
Remember when you couldn't, and a friend of mine, a lawyer, said something to me which I hadn't thought of, which blew my mind, and he's right. He said, do you realize that Donald Trump, because of this Supreme Court, will go down in history as one of the most consequential presidents we've ever had?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my thoughts.
And, right? And making him a person of consequence because you gave him the opportunity to stack the court, which they told you they were going to stack because when Merrick Garland was nominated, everyone was like, he's not liberal enough. Now, of course, he's AG and they're in trouble because he ain't telling them what he's doing right now. I think he's got a bag of tricks that we're about to.
I know everybody's like,
I don't think he's doing anything. But I believe that the Department of Justice is operating the way they're supposed to, unlike it did during the previous 4 years where they were telling you, I hate you and I'm going to kill you. They're not supposed to. They're supposed to. In any case, yes, I agree with you utterly. I try to tell people, like, it was never different. When 1968, when I was like 7, 8 years old, Nixon got elected because George Wallace split the white vote. So it was the first election after the Voting Rights Act, which white people never forgave the Democratic Party for. They just didn't. They've never voted overwhelmingly Democratic since then, except for Clinton and Obama a few times when white people got it together.
Yeah.
By the way, Bill Clinton warned you, Barack Obama warned you, and Hillary Clinton warned you before all this what was going on and said you need to vote every time like they do for the school board, for the judges in your neighborhood, for your local representative, for the House member of your district in California, not – you know, the president's one thing, but the president can only do this much. And I swear, like, white people are so, and believe me, I know a lot of them, and I work with them, and I am one. You know, like, white men really, really have their feet on the fucking dashboard. And, like, everybody blames white women because white women voted in majority for Trump. But white women are trying to protect themselves. They're caught up in the fucking Stockholm of being white, whereas white guys just simply don't care. They were mad in 1965 about the same thing they're mad about in 1865 and the same thing they're mad about now. I want to carry a gun. All the things you said. Mm-hmm. Nixon was the same. Reagan was the same. Ford was the same. HW&W didn't go like, I love everybody.
No.
They just played it different, and they were a little more like – and W, by the way, if anybody doesn't remember, was an awful, horrible, terrible president who abused his power.
That's what's comical, that Trump was so bad that people forget how bad W was.
W was literally the worst president in history until Trump.
Yeah.
And that's what I can't get over, that people have no memory of that. And now people go, well, I can't believe Biden hasn't done this and Biden hasn't done that. It's like, does anyone remember, like, let's just say May of 2020 or 2019. Yeah, when the plague started, May of 2020.
Yeah.
George Floyd, no one had a job. Everyone trapped. They were sending paramilitary people out in the street to shoot people and tear gas them that had no insignia, no badges, no names. An illegal army, our government was doing that to us. Then they didn't do anything about the plague, like rush the military act into where they could have sent masks to everyone. Instead, no, don't wear a mask. Science doesn't count.
Fauci, my body, my choice.
Except if it's a woman. I've been doing jokes about gun control and abortion for literally 35, 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing the same jokes. And
unfortunately.
So, I'm with you. I don't blame the people who've run for president as Democrats, because I think Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, that are perfectly good, valid, awesome, responsible, sober, decent people. They really did want to make everything better. Barack Obama was handcuffed.
Oh, absolutely.
In his presidency. One, he's black. So if he really stepped out of line or really said any – well, the one time he said, Trayvon Martin could have been my son. There was
a shitstorm. They lost their mind.
But he could have been. He has two black daughters.
Yeah, exactly.
Does no one understand?
Like, right. That's the thing. It was so simple. Like, yeah, a black man could have had a black son. Like that.
Right?
That doesn't mean I hate America or anything else. You know.
Yeah. So, like, I think he was enormously effective, considering what he had to deal with. And then I think white people fucking totally punted on the midterms in 2012 and 2014 when he needed our help.
I believe they will in 2022.
I'm really hoping not. And we'll do the good news at the end, so I'll save it for then.
Okay.
Because I don't like to sell gloom, but yeah, you know. So I think I agree with you utterly in that regard. I think that people blame white women a lot, and white women have a lot to answer for. But white men have everything to answer for. Let's be honest. Well, you look at the numbers, it's just there.
It's what they wanted.
Yeah.
But again, there's no secret about it.
No.
Now, let me ask you this about topical comedy, because this is my frustration, and you spoke to it. You've been doing jokes about abortion, gun control, ignorance for 30 years. I am tired, and I've said this before, I'm tired of joking about the same topics. We as a society will not move forward. I can give you my healthcare jokes from 2004.
Right?
They're still funny. I don't even know when I wrote my guns, teachers and guns mm-hmm. bit, and it still works, yeah. You know. Does it get frustrating for you as a comic that we are still talking about these same things that our society doesn't seem to move?
Yes. I think the audience's sensibilities have changed, particularly since I started in like the early 80s when it was cool to make fun of Asians and gays and really hammer on my girlfriend's so fat and, oh, look, there's a black guy in the front row. Don't leave your tip. You know, that mm-hmm. shit, which yeah. was common, mm-hmm. common. That's all like mostly disappeared
yeah.
from, you know, audiences don't tolerate it anymore.
Right.
They don't like racism and sexism as much as they used to.
Yeah. yeah. Well, the cheap stereotype jokes
yeah,
you can't
that
do.
Kind
you
of
can still
away.
Do you can still do cultural jokes, I think, but yeah. the cheap stereotype stuff is gone.
And then, like you say, like I was in Denver a couple years ago before the plague, and I was doing gun control. And you know, like when we move forward, right? Like we say, my jokes about gun control are hilarious. And, you know, a couple are a little too pointed. But as my wife always says, do a funny voice and that'll, you know, code it a little. Because Carlin certainly would, or Bill Hicks would. Bill Hicks would do the hillbilly.
Yeah.
The Pryor would do the street dude. Yeah. And, you know, they'd code it a little with
him. Right, the preacher.
You're talking about a homeless guy, but I'm going to do a funny voice so you ain't going to be sad about it. And I was talking about gun control, and this dude, and you know how Denver is. Denver's like any big city, but more so. There's a bunch of wonderful liberal-minded people there who think they're on the right track. But goddamn it, guns.
Yeah.
We love our – we want to hump them. We want to mm-hmm. – I want to kill them deer. I hate waterfowl or whatever it is they have a vendetta against. You know. And so this dude goes, I swear to you, in a lull – I hear him say, I don't want, and I'm not exaggerating the voice, mm-hmm. I don't want no gun control. And I said, I wonder, might we discuss this since we've heard from you? I go, since 16, you know, 19,
mm-hmm. right.
we've heard from you. We heard your side. Your side's been amplified. Your side's been codified. Your side's been set into stone. It is what the United States is based on. Guns to terrorize the populace and to keep everybody down.
Yeah.
And do you mind if we talk about it in a funny way for a minute? And then the crowd started turning on each other. And now I didn't have to do anything at this point. Now, fuck you. Well, fuck you. Yeah. You know, like now I've sort of created a fucking breakout session. And so, yes, I get frustrated because men almost 99.9% of the time feel super empowered to interject into your comedy when you're up there doing your philosophy. They feel real empowered to jump right in and give their opinion because they disagree with it. Whereas almost everyone else is happy to like just, okay, let's hear it and we'll laugh and then we'll go home and I'll write a letter or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or I'll fire off an angry email to the club that this guy was a communist. But I find that male empowerment really is the bane of everyone's existence. Guys will, in the middle of a giant role you're on, go, well, I think we should have, you know, and yeah. you're like, I don't care what you think. Right. I have the conch. Go out on the road for 30 years, develop some philosophy, read, and then come back and join me when you're as good as me. Because we're in my venue, you know? So that's where my frustration is. Like, I don't like to be challenged mm-hmm. because I've thought about it. You know, like, I listen to your comedy, and it's well-conceived, you understand the ideas you're talking about. You're not glibly glancing off of shit for low fucking, you know, mm-hmm. pot shots. You, the teacher with guns thing is a complete thought. And it's absolutely answers itself. You don't have to wonder what your point is,
right?
Because you're making the point, and people don't want to get to the end of that. And that's where my frustration is. The lack of wanting to go with you and allowing you to go there, because they have to – whatever petty precept they're holding is stopping them from – and I have to, you know.
Well, the other thing, and two things I want to address that you said. One, I love that you use the word communism, because I remember I was in Grand Rapids and I was doing doing a Sarah Palin bit back in, you know, 08, whenever it was, 07. And this guy yells, "I'm a communist." And I had to explain to the crowd, I was like, "Listen, you may not remember this, but back in the late 80s, and we really didn't like the communists." And that's what he's making reference to, because Soviet Union kind of collapsed and they're not really our enemies anymore. So a lot of you young folks might not even know what a good communist is. Well, I was, you know, so that was one. The other thing is, we put our name on it. When we say something, you know, it's like Twitter is, of course, the worst with it, with the bots and the knuckleheads and stuff. But I always say, hey, you not only know my opinion, you know my name, because I'm publicly standing in front of you saying this is what I think. Mm-hmm. You're a coward who doesn't even put his picture on his avatar.
Right. You've got a weird.
Or you're yelling. So it's like you're yelling from the dark in the back of the room. You said it. You haven't earned the right to say that. At least. You know, and this is the problem I have with a lot of these people now. Like, you know, you make the racist statement, like, what's her name, the idiot from Illinois?
Miller.
Miller, who says it's a victory for white life.
Uh-huh. And then went, oh, I didn't mean
that. No, don't back off. You said it.
Yeah, you did.
Own it.
Yeah.
Own it. Yeah. Don't. You said it's a victory for white life. No one in the crowd flinched. They're your
people. They cheered.
They love the statement, so don't back off of your statement. Mm-hmm. We don't.
No.
We're not allowed to, you know, I didn't know you wouldn't approve. So, you know, and I've said it a million times. Look, I'm not anti-gun. I'm anti-stupid. I know a lot of responsible gun owners. I know people who shoot for fun. I know people who hunt. You know, I used to tell them, listen, when Joe Rogan lived out here, I told Joe, listen, the world collapsed. I'm coming to your compound. You know how to kill stuff and live. I'm a follow you, you know. Right. So I don't mind you if you put your name on what you do and there's a responsibility or an intelligence to it. I'm anti-idiot.
And everybody's in it. People just blather and flap it. And I agree. Like, you know, I always say, I don't mind hearing your opinion, but I want to know why you think that. I don't want to just hear some reactionary bullshit that you heard or caught the zeitgeist of or saw online or one of your moron friends said it and now you're repeating it as a talking point. When I lived in England in the 90s, England was quite different then for one thing, but one thing I learned there – because it was demanded of you in polite conversation. If you made a statement like corporations run the world or some big political sweeping thing, English people would go, oh, do they and how so?
Mm-hmm.
In a conversation. Like in America, no one ever goes that deep.
Right.
We're glib. Mm-hmm. We're glib. Also, English people aren't your friend when they meet you. They're cold and indifferent. And then after you know them a while, then they become more friendly, whereas mm-hmm. Americans are like, hey, buddy, I love you. And then, hey, I need your help. I don't know you.
Yeah.
So there's our shallowness works in one way because we're funner, mm-hmm. but in another way. So in the 90s, I learned, and my wife said to me, you better be able to back up what the fuck you're talking about. You cannot just say, I say this.
And excuse me, I hate to interrupt, but next week your wife will be on the podcast because I'm more in love with this woman every minute.
Well, you know Jennifer. I mean, she'll call – you know, you have to have a voice that tells you you suck or you're doing too much or you're too drunk or whatever it is. And so I've been lucky to have that. And also to go like, think about other people. You're only – mm-hmm. You know, maybe think about like how a woman feels about a dude walking through the airport with mirrored shades and a glasses and camo glaring at everyone. How do you think it makes women feel?
Right.
How do you think it makes women feel that there's a president on TV screaming red-faced that women are liars? You know, you're a man. You can deal with it. It's for you, it's an angry guy, like a bunch of angry guys, you know. But think about maybe how someone else might feel about that. And then you think, oh, you're right. Perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of guys really don't want to sell perspective.
I have learned a ton in listening to women. In things that, just like you said, that I don't think about being a man and that they think about all the time. And this is just on the basis, of physical presence that they have to defend or at the very least be concerned for their physical well-being in situations that we never even think about. And that was so eye-opening to me, you know, and I joked about it from both sides. I will stand by the fact that, ladies, don't pack your bag too heavy to lift it and then look at me. All right? Now, when you packed it, you knew how heavy that was and you knew where the overhead was. So that's not my responsibility.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's her name? Cassidy Hutchinson, Ms. Hutchinson. Now, she's a dyed-in-the-wool believer. She worked for Ted Cruz. She worked for Steve Scalise. And Steve Scalise and Ted Cruz are really the bottom of the barrel of the Republican thinking, you know, Venn diagram. They're one step to the side of Baybard and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who are just pure chaos agents.
Yeah.
They're not there to legislate or even inform. They're there to foment.
Well, I said that Boebert's biggest – the reason she's so angry is Marjorie Taylor Greene has out-crazied her. Like, she thought she'd be the crazy one.
Yeah.
And Marjorie blew her right out of the water.
I can be stupider than you. I can repeat things that aren't true louder than you. I have a weirder look than you do.
Yeah.
And so that woman, you know, there's a big argument today about like whether she's brave or not. She's brave because we're up against mafia. I mean, this Republican Party that tried to coup the government are gangsters. Mm-hmm. And all those lawyers that you saw get up last week and cry and shit, they are too. Mm-hmm. They just didn't want to go to jail. They were smart enough at the end of the day to possess, as Harvey Keitel says, if your sense of survival is something you possess, I suggest you clean the fucking car. Mm-hmm. They got to the Jeffrey Clark point of the Justice Department being taken over by an insipid moron, more insipid than Jeff Sessions, which is something, and more evil than Bill Barr, which is really something.
Really something.
Like Bill Barr at the end of the day went, I'm not going to jail for you. Mm-hmm. And he quit.
Yeah.
And then this guy, Clark, like, I'll do anything you say, master. And that's when they pulled the trigger on this dude and were like, okay, I'm not doing 3 years because that's what'll happen. White collar guys do 18 months, 2 years, whatever. And they will. Mm-hmm. They will. A bunch of them will. Yeah. Everybody's all upset about, oh, my God, no one's gone to jail. They're going to.
I said that's when I'll be excited, not with the hearings. I want to see the perp walks.
Oh, dude, with the camp cuffs and then having to sulkily leave the courtroom. Like Manafort did a couple years. Cohen did a couple years. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody thinks nobody got punished. 5 or 6 guys did time already that aren't even have to do with the fucking sedition. And by the way, Nixon – Chuck Colson did, I think, 5 years, and Liddy did 5 years. I mean, John Mitchell, the attorney general, went to prison for 3.5 years. Yeah. The attorney general of the United States, I know your audience like, what, really? Yeah. So it's going to happen. And on the other hand, Terry Canfield is a professor at Berkeley and is a very astute tweeter because she's a defense lawyer, not a prosecutor. So her viewpoint is awesome. She only looks at it from how are they going to take the case apart when I get up there instead of you should fucking throw them in jail, you know. And she says, you know, okay, so we throw them all in jail. That still doesn't save democracy. Democracy has to be saved by the hard work of voting in every goddamn giving a shit about what's going on right now. And not going, I'm mad about what happened. Like, I'm mad about Hillary.
Taking the time. But, and there's one more thing I want to get to. And then the good news. But taking the time to read, just read the brochure they send you before they vote, you vote.
Right.
Because honestly, that's the one that identifies what this judge thinks and what that judge thinks or what this school board member says or what that one's. Because you're right. When you walk into the booth, no, you don't know who these people are. They're just names on the list. And you might throw a dart and hit the right name. But if you just take the time to read that pamphlet that they send you about 6 weeks before the election that you never look at,
lays on the kitchen table.
Read it and find out who these people are. And just quickly enough, like, oh, this was a teacher for 25 years. She'd probably be good on the school board, you know, versus...
I'm a real estate magnate who thinks that there's too much, politics is too cozy. I'm going to break the system apart tomorrow.
Yeah. So really quick, because I saw this speaking, it speaks to the women we were talking about and also your international experience. I don't know if you're aware of this tweet, but this woman, let me get her name. She's an Australian comedian, Lily Curry.
Okay.
And she basically said, and this is great, the Constitution is an old piece of paper written by rich white slave owners in wigs who are now dead. Why are we using it to determine how we live over 200 years later? Mm. And then she talked about how Jefferson said that, you know, it should, like, every 20 years we should be updating it. So this is what she said, quote, hey, please don't take this the wrong way. I do have a question. I'm still learning a lot about the United States because I'm really stupid, not from this country, but something I've noticed that every decision made in this country legally, specifically about human rights and whatnot, is made on the basis of a document from the 1700s. And she's right. Like, why is that? What is the obsession with the denying the fact that our society has changed, everything has changed, and yet this Supreme Court in particular, I mean, listen, I'm almost to the point where Clarence Thomas, if he wouldn't vote for slavery, he'd give it strong consideration.
Oh, yes, he would. Right? It's just shocking. Well, it's not shocking, like you say, because they let him. I think, you know, excuse me, because we were born out of violence and because we were born out of genocide against the people who lived here, and then the genocide of Africa, which is why North and South America have any money at all. Mm-hmm. South America had, what, 4 million slaves? Right. America had, what, about a million and something? At one point, more in some states than there were white people. There
well, that's
were
why enslaved the three-fifths rule.
Right.
Right, that's why.
To cut them down to size.
If you had allowed the slaves to be considered in representation, everything would have been different.
Right. Then South Carolina turns into a whole nother. And I think it's baked in. Like, from the beginning, or let's go right to the Constitution in the 18th century, those founding fathers. 12 presidents owned slaves, including Grant, who was probably one of the best presidents about reparations and trying to make things fair again. During his administration, there were loads of black people in Congress and a black senator. Mm-hmm. No one knows this. This was in the 1870s.
Right, yes.
And then when Hayes got in, because they threw that election, they went back to
the Jim Crow laws and the Klan.
But for one glorious eight-year period, he actually used federal troops to enforce civil rights laws all over the country. Black men were given the vote, which is what? That really happened after the Civil War. But it's baked in. The Supreme Court, the Senate, the Constitution and prison system are the slave state, modified. I mean, I said it once on my podcast, and it's a depressing fact, but it's true. The Civil War wasn't fought to free the slaves. The Civil War was fought to modify slavery so that it could be more palatable, which means a prison system, because as you know, the 13th Amendment.
Right.
The only clause in the 13th Amendment is, oh, if you're a felon, we can do whatever we want.
Yeah, then all bets are off.
Yeah, we can do whatever you want. So I think that's why. And then, you know, they really glommed onto the original intent of the framers thing. Well, the original intent of the framers was dastardly because other than John Adams and Hamilton, everyone owned slaves. I mean, they really were. Mm-hmm. And not particularly nice to them.
No.
I mean, they weren't benevolent like, oh, let's give them health care and stuff. It was like, I'm going to send slave catchers after you. I'm going to brand you and horrible things. So I think we have to look at that, and nobody wants to, and that's why they're so freaked out about the thing they call critical race theory, which they don't know what it is.
Right, they don't know what it is. Well, that's the truth, and when you talk about you can't handle the truth, Juneteenth, one of the funniest things about Juneteenth is, we've made it a holiday, but we're not allowed to tell the kids why.
Right. I mean, how about that? You know, and like, and then the, what is it in Florida? You're not supposed to say gay in school. So 11% of the population.
Right.
And our Secretary of Transportation, who's a right guy and everybody knows it. He's a smoker. What? He doesn't exist anymore? You know, like, okay. No, so I think, yeah, they really get hung up on it. It's a living, breathing document. And up until the 20th century, it was amended all the time. It ended, what, with like women's voting? Is that the last amendment? I mean, they really just stopped amending it because, it got too difficult to amend it. But there's no reason for it now. We actually have people of color and gay people in the government now, which, I mean, you know, we could talk about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, maybe for 10 years when Warren was the Chief Justice, 8 years, when Thurgood Marshall was on the court, they did everything that we talk about now. The Civil Rights Act, Miranda, the voting, you know, all those things. And then it went back to where it was because Nixon and Reagan made sure that they put right-wingers on. Judge Rehnquist shouldn't have been anywhere near a court.
Right.
He was a drug addict.
I'm a proponent of hugely expanding the Supreme Court to 25 justices so that no one has this much power.
That's crazy, right?
We need to make it big enough so that if one died, like when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, we were like, oh, no. Yeah. And all due respect to her, no one justice should make that much difference, just like The Handmaiden shouldn't, and certainly Clarence Thomas, you know. All right, we got
our handmaiden.
Yeah, I call it the drunk and the handmaiden. Uncle Clarence, the drunk and the handmaiden. Those are my three.
What was Samuel L. Jackson calling Uncle Clarence? Oh my God, that was devastating.
Uncle Clarence, that's who he is. Uncle Clarence.
Wow.
Greg, it has been phenomenal. I could talk to you for 4 hours and still cover everything.
Well, we haven't got to sit down and eat in a long time.
No, we haven't. We got to hang out. Well, we're back to work, which is good. We're back to work. Yeah. But give me the good news, my friend. Give me what's going on. And then tell the audience how to find you, how to listen.
All right. I'll be very brief. In my personal life, the good news is I have a new album out. I improvised it. And I'm telling people I improvised it. I improvised the album before, but I didn't say it. And nobody gave me any credit. And then I realized you have to tell people. And when I say improvise it, I had the idea of what I was going to do. And I made it up on the night. And because I'm a good comic, I can word things the way I want. Did it come out perfect? No. It's a kind of a document. Like I said things I wished I'd said differently. But having said that, and also it's really long. The new album's like an hour and a half. So
that's great.
Yeah. Most comedy albums are, what, about 38 minutes. Mm-hmm. This one's like, you know, the Eagles' greatest hits or whatever, except not as boring and no cocaine. So that's out. And then Jennifer and I read for Shakespeare and Company is a beautiful bookstore in Paris, with the English language bookstore. And we're friends with them. We've done the podcast there a bunch of times. And it's the 100th anniversary of Ulysses, the novel by James Joyce, which is this weird – I don't know how to describe it in two sentences. It takes a 24-hour day and turns it into a Greek epic like the Odyssey. And when I say a day, I mean – like poor Irish people going to buy milk and lighting a cigarette turns into this giant thing. So we read a chapter of it together, my wife and I, because they asked us to. So I was really excited about that. You can find all these things at gregproops.com. And then the other good news is I think – oh, well, the Whose Line's on the Road. We do vaudeville. So you don't have to – I'm not going to get up and talk about fucking – you don't have to feel guilty as a white person. You don't have to worry. I mean, every once in a while I'll call a guy out. Like the other night in Santa Cruz – I asked a woman what a favorite place was, and she murmured something. And I didn't hear, and I said, what? And her husband went, she said this. And I went, oh, I'm sorry. Was I talking to you? Or did you just decide to exert your male privilege and be louder than your wife so that we could all understand that you still had a place in the hierarchy here and that you weren't erased? They're like, when are we going to hear from men? When's that going to happen? So how many years can go by without hearing from men? And, of course, everybody laughed. So we're on the road and we do vaudeville. We lay on each other's faces. It's improv. So we sing funny songs. We talk about our knobs. It's great. And it's clowny. It's, you know, like you're talking about stand-up. It's a release from stand-up.
Yeah.
Because you're in a band. So I can't stop the band and go, I have a huge point I'd like to make about abortion here in the middle of this hilarious improv where you're laying on top of me.
The band's playing a song.
Yeah, we're playing a song. And then the other good news is, and I think – not to disagree with you, but to maybe expand on your point. Now's the time. The time is now. If you're mad about abortion and you're mad about the Supreme Court curtailing our civil rights, which is happening daily, for instance, the voters in Louisiana yesterday were cuffed roundly by what can only be described as an apartheid decision, the same kind of decision you would have had like Dred Scott. I mean, it literally is equal to historic decisions, Plessy versus Ferguson, blah, blah, blah. You guys can Google this shit later. if you're mad about that, if you're mad about the guns, the proliferation of weapons, which is definitely part of the white supremacist skein, you need to vote. And the good news is they're scared to death of you doing it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be freaking out so hard. They wouldn't have the Supreme Court furiously trying to take it away. They wouldn't be state by state trying to legislate voting away. So when Biden won, and he won in a giant landslide, and yes, he should have won by more electoral votes, but the electoral college is, the fourth element of the slave state that I forgot to mention. Why would you ever have an electoral college? To keep the will of the people from being done.
Right.
It's exactly the opposite of what it purports to be. So the voting is really powerful and strong. It really does matter. If we hadn't had Barack Obama two times, and then imagine where we would be right now. Yeah. If we hadn't elected Joe Biden, right now we'd be in year one of the plague, and the cities would be on fire, and you think there's police violence now.
Right. It'd be street war.
I mean, it's really important, and sometimes it really does come down to just you, dude. And so, if you're – they sent me a thing. They want money. The reason they want money is because they need money to run and shit. You can get mad at the messenger or whatever. If you don't elect a bunch of people who aren't Republicans, it's all going to go away, baby. And I think that's the motivation. And I think they are really popular right now. You see what happened in the primaries yesterday. The nutbags like Miller – and they're not nutbags. They're mainstream now. Let's be honest.
Crazy is mainstream.
Crazy is mainstream. Lauren Boebert is not an outlier in the party. She's actually speaking to the grandstand because they moved from – the good old Gerald Ford, Dick Cheney, right-wing asshole.
And when you say, listen to what you just said, the good old Dick Cheney,
right?
How have we reached a point where you actually said that out loud?
That warmongering
murderer.
Remember
the good old, Dick Cheney?
Who should have gone to prison in The Hague.
This is a war criminal.
If he was a foreign leader, he would have been in The Hague.
You said something that it's so profound, and we've been saying it forever. If voting wasn't so important, they wouldn't try so hard to stop you from doing it. They do everything possible to stop you from voting. So to all my listeners and listeners to this podcast, I think the vast majority do vote, and I appreciate it. Greg, thank you so much. To my audience, really quick, one thing I'm doing this week that I'm really proud and happy to be a part of, I'm part of a documentary called The Right to Offend. It's the history of black comedy in America. Premieres tonight. That's June 29th on A&E, and part two is tomorrow, and it'll be streaming on A&E. Everyone from Charlie Case through Dick Gregory through Richard Pryor up until today to, Tiffany Haddish and Chappelle and Chris Rock. I was super happy to be part of that.
Wow.
And I will be at Flappers in Burbank this weekend, July 1st and 2nd. So come on out and laugh. And to everyone in L.A., it is air conditioned because, we've been dealing with this heat wave, which is, good thing. I'm so glad global warming doesn't exist, because if it did, man, would it be hot outside. And
dude, we were in a tornado in Ontario last month, and the theater lost power, and it got it back like an hour before the show. And we really didn't know if we were doing – this is a crisis. The poor people of Ontario suffered. But a tornado in June in Toronto?
Yeah.
What? Oh, Japan's 100 degrees this week?
Yeah. Perfectly normal.
Oh, no. Don't worry. Go back to sleep. Sleep, my darlings. Sleep.
Ladies and gentlemen, do yourself a favor. Look up Greg Proops. Read Greg Proops. Listen to Greg Proops. Watch Greg Proops. And if Whose Line comes to your town or within 100 miles, drive and watch, because you get to see the best, and that's what's important, seeing the best. Like, he talked about Ornette Coleman, we talk about Miles Davis, in sports we talk about LeBron James or Tom Brady or whatever. That's what you're watching when you're watching Whose Line. You're not watching some improv group. All due respect, it's not a group of college kids or the improv school down the road.
Yeah.
These guys are the best, and you get to watch the best. Greg, thank you so much, man.
Thank you, Lonzo.
Love you, brother.
Love you, too.